Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
The Stanford Project, Napoleon and Josephine, Vladimir Putin, AR-15s and swastikas. This week's episode on Nicholas Cruz certainly delves into some very unusual topics as we see a very different person to the one we met at the beginning of this case.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions.
Police found 27 corpses.
Australia's worst serial killer.
Even though I didn't want to get in the car, I had to.
With Amanda Howard and Robert McKnight.
Hey there, I'm Rob McKnight and welcome to Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions. Joining me as always is Amanda Howard, true crime author, criminologist and also known as the Serial Killer Whisperer. Hello, Amanda.
Hello, Robert. How are you going?
Good, good, good. Now, as we record this, getting closer to your next museum event on October 7, was it?
That is right. Yep, on October 7 at Parramatta Jail. So it's a whole expo that's going on, but I have my special wing, which is all of my serial killer stuff and my death stuff and my JFK stuff and all of the weird and wonderful stuff that I continue to collect over the years. I've been working hard on that. I'm very exhausted, but we're getting there.
And if you want tickets to that, where do you go?
Just get me on Facebook, guys. I'm sure that there is a link, but I have no idea. But if you come to the MWM Facebook page or Twitter or someone, I can find you a link because I have no idea because I don't need to buy tickets. So, but just hit me up and I will send you the details, I'm sure.
Very professional. Seamless. Oh, my giddy aunt. All right, let's get back into the world of Nicholas Cruz because, as we heard over the last few weeks, Cruz was keen to speak to a psychologist and he was afforded that privilege, and they even went one better, having him interviewed by a psychiatrist, which occurred on March 1, 2022. So this is a few years after the shooting on Valentine's Day. Let's get into that. In the room is Dr. Charles Scott with Cruz. Now, there's an additional person on the edge of screen. Now, this is likely a police officer, a sheriff's deputy, a prison guard, that kind of authority person. They're both wearing masks because this was obviously during the time of COVID, and that will hide a fair amount of Cruz's facial expressions, and Cruz is also handcuffed. Additionally, there is only the sections that were played for the trial, and we begin with Dr. Scott asking about AR-15s.
If someone knew nothing about guns, how would you explain to them what an AR-15 is?
An AR-15 is a long rifle, and it's used as a sporting rifle.
Uh-huh.
It shoots in semi-automatic fire, and then there's fully automatic fire. A fully automatic fire is only meant for the military. No legal person is allowed to get it unless they have a firearms license or something like that in state Florida.
All right, and so, again, what's the difference between, for a complete novice, between a semi-automatic and a full automatic?
Fully automatic is continuous fire.
Okay.
And semi-automatic is single fire. So every time you pull a trigger, you only pull once.
Okay, so does that mean you have to pull for each time you fire it, or is it on its own?
So like that. Okay. Well, in fully automatic, you just hold on as long as possible until the rounds are completely empty.
Okay.
Wow. This is a very different Cruz, Amanda. I know we're 4 years on, but we've gone from that shocked, terrified and suicidal killer in the interrogations. This guy now is authoritative. He's got this authoritative demeanour about him.
Yeah, and this is about if he's crazy or not. If he was going to play up the demons card, this was the time to do it. But as you can see, it's not. He is verbose. He is concise. He's happy to talk with force, because he knows what he's talking about, when it's coming to guns. And this is about them seeing, does he understand the difference between reality and fiction, and, you know, what he did was wrong or right. And, you know, this is how he starts off. Like, this is very early in that interview. And for him to sort of go, oh, yeah, this is how you shoot, this is what it does, you know, it's just totally different. When I first heard these first couple of seconds, I was shocked by how he spoke. You know, similar to the guy that we saw, you know, I'm going to be a school shooter, peel, 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 similar to that guy. But it just proves that all of that happened with Curcio was all just a beautiful act.
Was it, though? I just wonder, in that moment, I'm sure he was terrified. I'm sure he was, because the consequences of his actions were coming home to roost. The guy's now been in prison for 4 years, and he's probably had to get hard to, or, you know, really harden up to survive prison life, surely.
Well, he's probably in holding rather than in Gen Pop, so I don't think he really knows what real jail is quite yet. But you can't be both of those people. So, yes, he was probably shocked by what he'd actually carried out and what he'd done, but that was still an act. Remember, he would play up the grunts and the pulling of the hair and everything, but would stop when Curcio would speak. When he was left alone for 4.5 hours by himself in the interrogation room, there was no auditory hallucinations. Nothing was going on. It was all just a beautiful performance.
I agree with that. I 100% agree with that. My thinking was that, you know, I felt there were times in that interview with Curcio that he did seem genuinely scared, or even the times when he was by himself. We know about the axe and the demon was all bullshit and all that kind of stuff, and I'm sure we're going to go down this path net during this chat with the psychiatrist. But I don't know. He's certainly different in his demeanour, and that's very evident, especially when you see the video on patreon.com/MWMconfessions or, of course, over at mwm.uscreen.io. He's just, the way he's sitting is very, very different.
Yeah, it is. He is sitting up straight. There is no longer that fear. Like, you know, it's – as you said, it has been 4 years since the shooting, since all the stuff that happened with Curcio. And so he has had to live with it all this time. And, yes, there is definitely reality now, and there's, you know, the court case going on and hearings and all of that, you know, but this is the time to play the card.
Yeah.
This is the time. And he didn't.
Yeah. Well, this next section is from 5 hours into the interview. Scott now asks about Cruz's time at school, and more specifically about his JROTC classes. And Cruz's answers, as you will see, are quite chilling.
I think 10th, partially 10th.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. So you went there, and how many people were in your class?
30 people at a time.
30 per class. And if you...
In JROTC, in morning, so we have different... to names for morning sessions in JRTC.
Uh-huh.
The morning session I was in first year was really short. There was not that many kids, so we had a chance to speak, get to know one another, build up our confidence with each other.
Okay, so was your JROTC, was that your first class of the day?
Yeah.
And that's when you went, and I just want to make sure I got the years right, because you left there roughly when you hadn't quite finished the 11th grade, is that right?
I think so, yeah.
And then...
I was doing really well in the class.
In the JROTC?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that. Who was your teacher?
John Navarro.
Okay, and I've never been in a
Sergeant John Navarro.
In a JROTC class. So tell me what happens in a JROTC class.
JROTC is the short-term definition of JROTC is Junior Officer Training Corps.
Okay.
It's supposed to make you ready to go into the military, because that's what I wanted. I wanted to seek a military career in the K-9 unit. If not K-9 unit, then Army Ranger School. So I was trying to learn everything I can about the military.
Uh-huh.
So the first step was to go into JROTC, take a class on marksmanship, because I wanted to experience that just to get an idea of what it's like. And I learned a lot.
Okay, tell me what you learned about marksmanship.
I learned how to shoot a gun. I learned how to zero in a rifle.
What does zero in a rifle mean? I don't know what that means.
It means to shoot dead center or shoot on impact.
Okay.
Where you want to shoot your target, like, see that bottle?
Yeah.
If you want to shoot the top of that, you're supposed to zero it in, so you keep shooting it until you're able to get the cap off or something.
Okay.
That's when you're ready.
Okay. What type of training gun or whatever did they use?
We didn't do anything that you see on TV.
No?
No. What we did was we sat on a platform, like a little like green thing, and then we set up our rifles. We found like little things around our arms, and we had some sort of air pellet gun, which I think functioned on CO2 gas. So we had cylinders in it. So we pull back the thing, and you're supposed to put it in the thing, and we're supposed to let go. And then you look, and it's supposed to hit the target about 10 meters. So we set up these like targets 10 meters. And there's, what was it, prone, kneeling, and then standing.
Okay. And three different positions you have to learn?
Three positions, yeah. And so that particular...
How did they determine if you were good or not?
You have to shoot a target at 10 meters the size of a dime or a quarter.
Okay.
They actually decreased in size over the years. I don't know if it's... I heard it's a penny now.
Okay. So overall, how did you do as a mark in that class or in that JRTC? Were you
I was in the top one. I was probably the third or fourth one from being top in the class.
Okay.
The females are a lot better at shooting than men.
And that's because?
They're just better shooters.
Okay.
Even the Marines did their own study on that. It's true. Women are better shooters than men.
Okay, and so anything else you learned in that class?
I learned leadership skills. I learned...
Give me some examples of some leadership skills.
Whenever someone's in need, you're supposed to go up to them and make sure they're all right. If someone were to challenge you in a fight, you're supposed to walk away from it. If you're marching and someone falls down, you're supposed to help them up. And if someone's having issues with some sort of class, you're supposed to help them out.
Okay.
You're supposed to stick up for one of them. That's what they're supposed to be about.
Okay.
It's interesting, Amanda. You said this a moment ago. What we're seeing here is the arrogance of the guy who was in those videos leading up to the shootings. You know, the way he talked on camera is full of arrogance and boastfulness, and that's what he's doing here. He's using hand movements to show the psychiatrist, you know, how the guns work and what he learned in these classes. There's a lot of bravado here.
Yeah, absolutely, you know, and he's wanting to be that expert. But the irony, oh, you're supposed to help your peers if they fall down. Oh, you're supposed to show leadership skills. You're supposed to walk away from fights, you know, everything he didn't do. So, you know, like he doesn't see that that's an issue that, you know, that because, you know, people being in the ROTC is not going to make a school shooter. And it literally shows that they're teaching them the responsibility of serve and protect, basically, and he decided to go in the other direction, you know. But it's just, it's interesting how, oh, you know, such and such did a study on females being better shooters and all things like this. Like, why why is he going into these details except to say, I know stuff that you don't? Because apparently the psychiatrist doesn't know about guns, and I'm sure that's not really true. I mean, even I know the basics, but I know that he's just trying to get Cruz to extemporize on
the information
that he does have. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Well, after another small cut in the footage, Cruz goes into detail about the tests he needed to take to get a good job in the military.
So tell me about that. You mentioned that earlier this morning.
So in order to go into the military and get a good job in the military, you have to score high on the ASVAB first. The ASVAB is a crazy test.
Tell me about some of the questions and what it was like, best you remember.
Here, I can write down something.
Okay. Let me take out this piece of paper. I've never taken it, so I don't...
It's crazy tough.
Okay, give me some examples.
Okay, so Cruz has just been handed a notepad so he can write down a number of questions, and Scott will then ask him about them in this next clip.
Let me see what you wrote here.
Those are just small examples. It gets really, really complicated and tough.
So what is an H2O molecule? What's this right here?
What is a H2O molecule of water?
Of water.
Yep.
And what would your answer be to something like that?
Hydrogen, and what was the other one? Helium, I believe.
Okay, and then what does this say?
Who was Josephine during the French Revolution?
And what's the answer to that?
It was Napoleon's ex-wife.
And then this last one?
What's the square root of 256?
And what's an answer to that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Made up.
But would these be questions, are these exact questions from that test or just similar to what?
Those are simple questions. I can't put in, like,
okay.
Give you the one. It gets really complicated.
Okay. So he is writing down example questions of what would have been in his military tests. Is that what I'm understanding here?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's, yeah.
And he got them all wrong.
Yeah. So H2O is not hydrogen and helium. So,
Even I know that one. I was going to make a joke. We know it's water, but the problem is if I made a joke and got it wrong, people would think I'm being serious because I'm not that smart.
Like the square root of 256 is 16, and I actually know that because I work in fours in my job, and so 16 is the thing I have to know. But he goes in to talk about Napoleon and Josephine, and it's weird and wonderful. These are the questions that he picked up on, you know, but. Before, you know, when he's talking to Curcio, he's saying things like, you know, I'm dumb, I'm stupid, I don't need to be here and everything. He's not now. He's saying, yeah, I don't know the answers to some of these because they're really hard. But he's showing that he had researched them, he had looked at them, he had planned on his career progression if he was to go into the army. You know, this is him showing that he has those planning skills, that it proves that the school shooting, as we very well know, wasn't like, oh, today I've got the shits, where the world I'm going to go and shoot it up. That it was carefully planned. And it's these sorts of points that they look at to say, yeah, this isn't someone who is off with the fairies and doesn't know what he's talking about. This is someone who is concise and carefully plans things. And though he may not be the smartest tool in the shed, and thank God he didn't get into the army, you know, he's willing to give it a go, and it was a focus for him.
Mm. Well, Scott continues asking about his schooling and prompts Cruz to talk about his psychology class.
Did you ever take any kind of psychology or psych 101?
Well, yeah, I did take psychology. I actually scored pretty well.
Okay.
And I passed the test, too.
Okay. And that was at the Dave Thomas campus?
OCLC. Yep.
And so OCLC.
The only class I actually passed any.
Okay. What kind of things did they teach in the psychology class?
Well, they didn't teach anything. It was just basically we were just doing things on computer.
Yeah, what kind of topics on the computer were there?
People with mental health, past tests, such as the one where they practiced this test on prisoners and guards.
Uh-huh.
So basically what happened was there was this test back in, I think, the 80s or 60s, and they had like a bunch of inmates become security guards, and security guards become the inmates. And it didn't turn out well. Actually, the security guards turned against the inmates and treated them horribly, which came up with a theory that if you put someone in a situation and under certain circumstances, they'll abuse that power.
Yeah, it's a famous study, actually.
Okay, so he seems like he knows his stuff, Amanda. He's boasted again there about doing really well.
Sorry, I have to laugh at the way that he just explained the Stanford Prison Experiment. It's just anyone who's done psychology knows about that because it's basically 101 that we all
know. Yes, of course. Everybody knows about that. I just didn't bring it up because I wanted to give you the opportunity to explain it.
You don't know? That's okay.
I've never done psychology.
Well, maybe you should.
I read people very well. Right now I can tell you're mocking me.
Yep.
I don't need some Stanford research paper to tell me that. Thank you very much. I got street smarts.
Yeah, well, true. Yep, streets, yep, okay. it's interesting that psychiatrist actually doesn't correct him on that. So it's what he says is kind of right, but it's totally wrong because it was university students that they had do this experiment. Some were guards and some were prisoners, and they were brought into the room. And this was supposed to go on for several weeks, but it didn't because of the abuse of power that did occur. And
but that happens in any kind of research that's done. That as soon as people obtain the power, and there's always a class system, you always find that people fall into those roles. If there is a hierarchy,
yeah.
And see,
exactly.
I may not have done psychology, but there are things I know about. But as soon as you see people put into groups of the haves and have-nots, if you like, they always fall into those roles, and there is some kind of abuse of power.
Absolutely, and that's what Harry was trying to talk about. But it's interesting that the psychiatrist went, "Oh yeah, that's a famous study," and kept going. But the more interesting
I felt that was his way of letting him know, I know what you're getting wrong, but I'm not going to make a big deal of it.
Yeah. Well, because it's not about him explaining things to Cruz. But what we also see is that Cruz is speaking very, very quickly, and it's abrupt, and it's pressured. He's trying to sort of make sure that he's heard clear and concise. If that's because of the mask a bit that he wants to make sure he's heard, I don't know. But he's actually making sure that what he's saying is being heard, and that he is sort of still being boastful. So, you know, oh, yeah, I had to do psychology and we did this and we did the Stanford Project and all of this sort of stuff that it's this bravado that we didn't have before, that he's trying to now portray himself as smart, intelligent, though not quite as intelligent as he may think he is, you know, and that he's there to sort of prove how great he is rather than how broken he should
be. But you think he's feeling pressured here?
No, pressured speech means that it's not just like, you know, whatever, blah, 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 blah. He's out there, he's forcing it out.
Right.
He's projecting. Yeah.
I mean, would make sense if he's feeling pressured, because this is his chance to show the demons were real, and this is his get out of jail free card, isn't it? If he can convince them that he had psychological issues when he did the shooting. So there is pressure here.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. But I think he forgot.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't mentioned them yet, so
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Anyway, the conversation now turns to swastikas. And Cruz has a few interesting and insightful responses.
Any time where someone might have thought you were carving like a swastika on a table or something like that?
My friends told me to do that, and they did it as well. And okay. I did that for attention. And anything that I put swastika or said nasty remarks about the race or gender equality or anything like that was all for attention.
Okay.
In that magazine, I'm sure you know about it. I had a magazine with a swastika on it for my AR.
Yeah.
I didn't write that at all.
Where'd that come from?
Jameson Todd asked me if he wanted to draw a swastika on it. And so I said, sure.
Okay, so I didn't think
any of it.
So he drew the swastika on the magazine?
Yeah. We were just chilling out. He said, it's cool if I draw a swastika on your magazine. I said, sure.
Okay. And was that magazine used on the day of the offense?
Yeah.
Okay. Was it left there at the scene?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
And then someone told me I had a swastika on my boot. I did do that, but that was for attention.
Okay. When'd you put the swastika on the boot?
Probably half a month before.
Okay. And what kind of attention can you get from having a swastika on you?
Negative or positive. It can be either way, because the swastika was used in Native American as a peace symbol. And then when the Germans saw, I guess they took it up themselves and they made it into a symbolic symbol, which was really stupid because it was a Native American peace symbol.
Okay. But when you would put on your shoe for attention, which of those two was it most likely to kind of connect to or represent?
Mostly peace.
Okay.
Mostly peace. That's a very interesting response. He also said he did it to get attention, but he also made the very pointed note that the shooting had no racial motives behind it, Amanda.
Yeah, it's interesting when people have that point that they will not cross. You know, it's like when we did Ed Kemper many, many seasons ago, where we talked about him being embarrassed. He said he he brushed his hand against one of his victim's breasts and was embarrassed and apologized. The fact is he then took a gun and put it to her head, he wasn't offended by it, but he didn't want this girl to think, oh, that he was being inappropriate. It's weird that they have these distorted thoughts about things and the swastika being mostly peace. That's just a cop-out for him trying to say, you know, he wasn't trying to be big and, you know, trench coat mafia assault sort of thing. This is about him just trying to say that, oh, you know, we're all doing it and it wasn't a thing. He didn't want this to be seen as a racially motivated crime. And he did certainly did not discriminate in his victims, you know, white, black, Hispanic, Chinese. There was a whole gamut. So it wasn't about as shooting at black kids. And as we know, his brother is a person of colour. So, you know, I think he wanted to make sure that that is known. But then you have to think about, well, if you're doing a symbol of hate, regardless about it being mostly about peace, with your brother being a person of colour, like, you know, don't you think that that was very insensitive to do, even if it was just, you know, for attention?
Mm. You know, you mentioned Ed Kemper, and there are two episodes or two cases we've done that I've always felt I'd love to go and redo on the video feed because they were before we had the video part of this podcast. Ed Kemper is one of them. And the other one is the cult with Flavor Aid. What was that?
Jim Jones.
Jim Jones. I've always thought they're the two I'd like to go back and do as a video.
Yeah. I actually have Jim Jones's head just here, actually. That's why I was looking off camera.
Of course you do.
So if you come to the museum, you will see Jim Jones because I will have a life-size Jim Jones there at the display to get your photo with. So it's a shameless plug, I know. But, I think Kemper would be a good one because there is a lot of film of Kemper.
Mm.
Jim Jones, not so much, but I think it's certainly something that we can look at once we've done the Kennedy one.
Yeah, but they had the video, didn't they? Or am I confusing this? And sorry to go on a tangent. Didn't they have video of the final moments and everything like that?
Not as far as I'm aware. I know it's a tape recording and he played countless
it's a tape recording.
Recordings for years. Ah, well. But I know there is some stuff out there. There is some of him preaching that we can probably look at.
All right. Well, once again, you've listened in on a production meeting, so let's continue with this podcast. Because what we've just heard, that conversation concluded the first day session that Cruz had with Dr. Scott. The following day, they picked up where they left off with Scott asking about other therapists Cruz may have seen.
Any other counselors that you can remember? You talked about Jared.
There's like a woman that wanted me to get into chess, and she also wanted me to try a bunch of pills, see if that would relieve any stress.
Right.
There was also...
And did you end up playing chess?
No.
Yeah? Can you play chess?
It wasn't my interest. I didn't even play it right. I've only learned that I was playing wrong throughout my years.
Okay. And can you play chess now?
Not very good at it.
Oh, yeah. Tell me what you remember about some of the different names of the chess pieces. What are some of the names?
Oh, we got the rook, we got the king, the queen, okay. The knights. Oh, the other one. I forgot what bishop.
Okay.
And the pawns.
Okay. That sounds like all of them. And do they move in different ways?
Yeah, they move in different ways.
Okay.
The knight goes like an L form.
Okay.
The king goes pretty much anywhere, but only one spot at a time. The queen can go anywhere on the chessboard. I think the bishop goes sideways, and then the rooks just go up or left and right.
Okay.
I think that's about it.
Do they allow you to play chess in here at all?
Yeah.
And who do you get to play chess with?
My psych doctor.
Okay. And are you able to, how do you do?
Terrible.
Terrible.
I think he's cheating someone.
How do you mean?
Huh? He always uses his queen.
He always uses his queen?
Yeah, he always uses his queen.
What does that mean? I don't play chess, so.
So the queen is probably the most powerful piece on the board, so he uses that a lot, and he always gets me with it.
Okay.
And then we play Uno, and I usually crack up jokes with him. It's pretty fun.
Okay. And which doctor is this? What's his name?
Dr. K.
How do you spell last name? K, you said?
Yeah, I call him Dr. K. I can't pronounce his full name.
Okay. Is he a treating doctor here?
Yeah.
Okay.
that all sounds pretty right about the chess. I feel like we're asking questions. Why do we care if he's playing chess and who he's playing it with?
Well, I don't know anything about chess except for what I learned in the first episode of Queen's Gambit, so I learned nothing. I think it's about them seeing his thought processes. So when you play chess, it's a game of strategy and planning, and I think that's where, you know, they're trying to see, you know, does he know how to play a few steps ahead, because we really know that he only planned the school shooting up until the shooting. We don't really think he thought after that. So then it become about voices. So I think it's them looking at what he sort of lied about to Curcio when he was saying, you know, oh, I didn't look into anything and I don't know. And yet we know he was looking at the Aurora cinema shooting, that he had looked at the Columbine kids. He was playing Pumped Up Kicks, which is now in my head again, you know, and all of this planning that he did for months and months and months. So this is now teasing that out, because this is now what we find out that Curcio didn't know that first night. So it's about just seeing what he thought, and obviously he prefers to play Uno, and I get that because I do too.
Well, as you said, it's all about planning. That's where Scott is taking the interview, as he next asks Cruz about planning the shooting.
And so you shared with me that you had this thought about shooting up the school.
For a very long time.
When did it first, and we talked about this earlier this morning, but when did the idea first pop in your mind or you first think about it?
14, 13.
Age 13 or 14?
Yeah.
And what was it at age 13 or 14 again that this thought came up? Was it when you were reading the books that we were talking
about? Yeah, I was reading books. Okay.
And did it ever go away, or did it kind of come and go?
Come and go, pop up in my mind one time and then just disappear for the next.
What seemed to make it come and what seemed to make it go?
When I saw a lot of violent videos on YouTube.
Okay, what kind of violent videos did you see?
War videos, Syrian war videos.
And did that make it more go up or more go down?
More go up.
Okay.
And then I watched documentaries.
Okay, what kind of documentaries?
A Columbine Massacre documentary.
Right.
I think it was 42 hours or something.
Uh-huh.
There was another one, same thing, but with Virginia Tech.
With Virginia Tech?
Yeah, Virginia Tech. And there was one on Elliot Rogers.
Do you remember if you ever kind of searched out on the internet ways to do a school shooting? Yeah.
I did my own research.
Yeah, tell me what research you did.
I looked up on Wikipedia. I studied mass murderers and how they did it.
Uh-huh.
Like their plans and what they got and what they used.
And what did you learn from that kind of study?
I learned that the Columbine shooters, they had three guns that they used. They used a High Point 9995 regular. They used a double barrel shotgun cut down pistol grip. They used another shotgun, and they used a Tech 9. I learned that from there. I learned the Virginia Tech shooter, he had a tactical vest and he had two pistols, Glock 9s, I think. I can't remember. I don't remember what brand, but he went to the gun range and he sighted them in.
Okay.
And I learned about Aurora Borealis. Guy used a Smith & Wesson MP15 Sport 2. And how I know he used it, it doesn't even say on Wikipedia, but it actually shows the brand on police documents.
Okay. And so you could figure it. You figured that out,
yeah,
what he used?
Yeah.
And when you said Aurora Borealis?
Movie theater shooting in Colorado.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
James Holmes?
Yeah.
It's always interesting, isn't it, that this what leads violence? Is it what you see that starts you on a violent road, or is it already within you? This guy went looking for information. It wasn't because he saw this information that made him a killer, Amanda. He went looking for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of his discussions there, all the violent films, you know, created this. That's a load of bullshit. Now,
completely.
I do talk about that they can entice you, but they can't create you. So
yep.
As I always say, I watched Silence of the Lambs and I wanted to be Clarice Starling. Someone else will watch Silence of the Lambs and want to be Buffalo Bill. I mean, this is what happens. And it's not because I was a good person and wanted to go in this and they're a bad person that go into that. It's how they see themselves. So, you know, I look at Columbine from a very different angle than to what he would look at it from, you know, and that's what it is. It's it's about what you select, because that's what you want to see. You look at what you want to have encouraged in your life. You know, if you want to get fit and healthy, well, then you watch fit and healthy things. If you want to go dark and horrible, you go and watch things about the Holocaust and horrible things like that. It's about, as you said, it's about going looking for what you want that will encourage you. But this was his plan. He knew he was going to do this. This wasn't created by him watching, you know, World War II films. This is what was in him. And I have to have a laugh because he caught the Aurora shooting, the Aurora Borealis shooting, and that just made me laugh a bit because that's a bit stupid. But that's just my humor. I'm sorry.
We like your humor. That's why we're here. All right. Scott further delves into what Cruz gained from his research, and his responses are just horrifically real, knowing exactly that we know how the shooting played out.
So I'm talking about the days leading up to the school shooting.
I already had the magazines. I had all the ammunition. It was just there.
It was already there.
I just didn't have anything to do with it.
So nothing special. You had to go out and buy it a couple days beforehand. Okay, you already had it?
Already had it. It was just the ammunition that I didn't have, so...
Okay, and so one thing is you had this vest and you put the ammo in. What else did you do?
I put the gun in one of the safety bags, gun bags.
Yeah, tell me what a safety bag looks like. I haven't seen
it. It kind of looks like that right there.
Okay.
See that red one? Yeah.
Where'd you put the gun in the safety bag?
The night prior, right after I practiced a little bit, sighted in.
Yeah, and where'd you go to practice again? You told me.
In the backyard. Like trying to imagine the recoil.
Yeah, that's right. That was at the Sneed's house. They had a place outside you could do that.
Yeah.
And you said you're figuring out the recoil?
Yeah.
Recoil.
Recoil.
Recoil. Okay. And so the night before, the gun went into the bag. And did anything else go into that bag? It was like a gun bag. What else?
Acid.
That's it.
Yeah,
just the gun.
And whatever was on the gun.
And what was on the gun?
A grip. Tactical grip.
What's that?
It's like, I can draw it.
Okay, you're good at drawing it. There you go.
Okay, and then give me the gun again.
Absolutely.
I'm going to show you all the components.
Yeah, just tell me about what a technical grip is.
So I had a rail system on it, so it looked kind of different. And you can put a tactical grip on it. It's just a grip. So you basically screw it into the gun.
What's the point of having...
To keep it steady.
Okay.
And then same thing with the bipod. Bipod kind of looked like that a little bit.
All right. But you didn't use a bipod, did you?
No, it was already on the gun.
It was already on it. Okay, and so...
And yeah, that's about it. That was on the gun. Oh, and what was it? The sling.
Okay, so what's the... You can hand me that back. Was the tactical grip already on the gun, or did you put it on the night before? Or
it was already on there for a while.
For a while. And the sling was on there?
Yeah, I just recently put on the bipod.
Okay. And so when you had this, the bipod was actually on the gun when you put it into the gun bag?
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's the night before. About what time of night are we talking about?
Well, early morning, really.
Yeah, it might have even...
Yeah, I didn't get any sleep.
Okay. So this is on February the 14th, early morning?
Eight or nine
in the morning?
Not eight or nine. No, it was 5:30. And I sighted in at around 12 o'clock in the night.
The night before? Like on the 13th, or like midnight, you mean?
Yeah, midnight, yeah.
Tell me what sight it in means again.
Sighting in?
Yeah, sighting in. What does that mean?
To get the bullet on target where you want to shoot at.
Okay.
So I have to look at the rear front sight and put the laser on top.
How long does it take to do that?
Can I try?
Sure. Just I'm trying to understand.
So, yeah, I'm trying to make you understand.
Yeah, you're helping.
Okay. So there's like this. This is the front sight. This is what it looks like on the AR. So this is a rear sight, the circle thing, and this is a front sight.
Okay.
And you want to put the laser just a little bit right above it. That's your point of aim. And so this is what it kind of looks like when you're shooting a target. I like that.
Okay, yeah. How does that laser, how does the sight, how does that help you in your shooting?
So when it's in the gun, it's stabilized.
Okay.
So wherever the red dot goes is your point of aim. because that's where the bullet's going to come out.
Okay.
Out of the gun, and that's how you sight it in.
All right. Does it help in any way with the shooting?
Yeah. So right after you take it out, you put a bullet in, and then you actually fire, see if it actually shoots on at where you just sight it in to target where the red dot is.
Uh huh.
And there you go.
Okay.
All right.
All right, so that was the sighting. How long does it take you to do the sighting the night before? You told me earlier yesterday.
I think it was about like 30 minutes to an
hour. 30 minutes to an hour? Okay.
He's not even trying to deny that he's the killer here, and we know how true that all was. This, Amanda, isn't a person with schizophrenia or voices in his head. He knew that the active shooter protocol as that final safety technique to keep kids at school, or indeed anyone caught in a mass shooting anywhere, isn't going to be effective. He knew he had 20 minutes. He began shooting at 2:21 p.m. He fled at 2:28 p.m. He killed 17 people. Guards, deputies, and police in or around the school are told to stay at least 500 feet away at this point. As we heard over the radios during the shooting that we played probably back in episode one, a few deputies do enter the school, though, at 2:32, but most of them assembled team do not enter until 3:11 p.m. That's almost an hour after the shooting began and 43 minutes after the shooting had stopped. This is not going to save anyone.
No, it's not. And that's what this comes down to. They know they have to go in, fire, and get out if they want to escape. If he wanted to go down suicide by cop, he would have stayed. He wouldn't have cared about that protocol. But, you know, the protocol failed. And as we heard, and in our final episode, we will go through what happened to those guards. You know, they said, stay away. Don't come near it. This is an active shooter. They say it's an active shooter. And they still say, "I'll stay away from Block 1200, which is where it all went down." And Cruz knew that. This is him showing how he wrote his list. He knew what he needed to do. He knew he had to keep to a time frame. He knew that that was the time that the kids are going to be coming out of classrooms. He knew to do the fire alarm to get the greatest maximum population of kids there. The fact he only killed 17 is quite surprising. And we have seen the footage of the kids in their classrooms, and no one's coming for them.
Yep.
And this killer knows that no one is coming because no one goes in. We had that recently, probably a year or two ago now, where there was that primary school that was shot up, and one of the police officers there was a father of a child in that school, and they told him, no, you can't go in.
Mm.
And it was supposed to, after Columbine, to save kids. You know, the fact that there are school shootings, that's a whole other argument, but we're talking about how they could have saved people. And the fact that Cruz knew that this is what they should do and knew what that time gap is. He had done that much research. He knew, you know, go in, do this, you know, like an Ocean's 11 kind of thing, that he knew what he had to do and how to get out quickly. He knew by wearing his ROTC uniform he would blend in. You know, it's not, you know, some guy, I don't know. It's just so frustrating that, you know, and we've been working under this for months and it still gets me that they were told to stay away, not go in and kill this guy.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the interview skips again and Scott takes the conversation into the pre-planning of the shooting.
So I'm talking about the days leading up to the school shooting. You were talking.
Yeah, I already had the magazines. I had all the ammunition. It was just there.
It was already there.
It was already there. I just didn't have anything to do with it.
So nothing special. You had to go out and buy it a couple of days beforehand. No. Okay, you already had it.
Already had it. It was just the ammunition that I didn't have. So.
Okay, and so one thing is you had this vest and you put the ammo in. What else did you do?
I put the gun in one of the safety bags, gun bags.
Yeah, tell me what a safety bag looks like. I haven't seen
it. It kind of looks like that right there.
Okay.
See that red one? Yeah.
Yeah, when did you put the gun in the safety bag?
The night prior, right after I practiced a little bit, sighted it in.
Yeah, and where'd you go to practice again? You told me.
In the backyard. In the backyard. Like, trying to imagine the recoil.
Yeah, that's right. That was at the Sneed's house. They had a place outside you could do that.
Yeah.
And you said you were figuring out the recoil?
Yeah.
Recall.
Recoil.
Okay. And so the night before, the gun went into the bag. And did anything else go into that bag? It was like a gun bag. What else?
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah,
just the gun.
And whatever was on the gun.
And what was on the gun?
A grip. Tactical grip.
What's that?
It's like... I can draw it.
Okay, you're good at drawing. There you go.
Okay, and then give me the pen again.
Absolutely.
I'm going to show you if you want a sec.
Yeah, just tell me about what a technical grip is.
So I had a rail system on it, so kind of different. And you can put a tactical grip on it. It's just a grip. So okay. You basically screw it into the gun.
What's the point of having...
To keep it steady.
Okay.
And then same thing with the bipod. Bipod kind of looked like that a little bit.
All right. But you didn't use a bipod, did you?
No, it was already on the gun.
It was already on it.
Yeah.
Okay, and so...
Everything. And yeah, that's about it. That was on the gun. Oh, and what was it? The sling.
Okay, so what's the... You can hand me that back. Was the tactical grip already on the gun, or did you put it on the night before? Or
it was already on there for a while.
For a while. And the sling was on there?
Yeah, I just recently put on the bipod.
Okay. And so when you had this, the bipod was actually on the gun when you put it into the gun bag?
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's the night before. About what time of night are we talking about?
Well, early morning, really.
Yeah, it might have even...
Yeah, I didn't get any sleep.
Okay. So this is on February the 14th, early morning?
Eight or nine.
8 or 9 in the morning?
Not 8 or 9, it was 5:30. And I sighted in at around 12 o'clock in the night.
The night before? Like on the 13th, or like midnight, you mean?
Yeah, midnight, yeah.
Tell me what sighted in means again.
Sighting in?
Yeah, sighting in. What does that mean?
To get the bullet on target where you want to shoot at.
Okay.
So I have to look at the rear front sight and put the laser on top.
How long does it take to do that?
Can I try?
Sure. Just I'm trying to understand.
So, yeah, I'm trying to make you understand.
Yeah, you're good. You're helping.
Okay. So there's like this. This is the front sight. This is what it looks like on the AR. So this is a rear sight, the circle thing, and this is a front sight.
Okay.
And you want to put the laser just a little bit right above it. That's your point of aim. And so this is what it kind of looks like when you're shooting a target. I like that.
Okay. Yeah. How does that laser, how does that help you in your shooting?
When it's in the gun, it's stabilized.
Okay.
So wherever the red dot goes is your point of aim, because that's where the bullet's going to come out.
Okay.
Out of the gun, and that's how you sight it in.
All right. Does it help in any way with the shooting?
Yeah. So right after you take it out, put a bullet in, and then you actually fire, see if it actually shoots on at where you just sight it in to target where the red dot is.
Uh huh.
And there you go.
Okay.
Alright.
Alright, so that was the sighting. How long does it take you to do the sighting the night before? You told me earlier yesterday.
I think it was about like 30 minutes to an
about
hour.
30 minutes. 30 minutes to an hour? Okay.
I have to say, Amanda, this is such a different interview than the interrogation with Curcio, isn't it? Very different tone to it.
Yeah, it is, and it's more about him telling this psychiatrist like the things about the guns and how he prepped it and what he had to do to make sure that the sight was right, even though his gun did actually backfire the first shot he tried to do, so he hadn't planned that carefully. But Scott is using words like shooting and things like that, which we didn't hear Curcio say at all, and Cruz isn't triggered by it. He isn't concerned or shying away from it. He's showing exactly how he set up that kit bag the night before to know what he was going to go in and do.
Mm. It's information sharing in a way. You know, like he's just not afraid to be putting that information out there and saying exactly what happened. He's, at this stage, take away the demons in his head, which hasn't come up, he's got no defense here. He literally is just saying what happened and not even trying to pretend that it wasn't him. Look, Scott then asks Cruz about the clothing he wore, and again Cruz's answer gives us further insight into the mind of a mass murderer.
The night before, you're out, you're at the Sneeds, you're in their backyard for 30 minutes to an hour with the AR-15. You come back. What are you even wearing the night before? Do you remember what you were wearing the night before?
My JRTC polo shirt and khaki pants.
Yeah, why are you wearing your JRTC polo shirt?
To disguise myself if I do go in.
Okay.
Because if I had all that gear on there, I would have called cops and held them in that.
And then you were in khakis?
Yeah.
And were you wearing the same thing the night before as you were in the day of? Or did y'all change clothes?
No, I changed clothes. Okay. I was wearing, before the day of the shooting, I was wearing a sweater, my camouflage shirt, my beanie.
This is the night before?
Yeah, like I told you, I used to cover myself.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
So when did you put on the JRTC polo shirt?
Probably around 12 o'clock at midnight after I sighted my rifle.
Okay. And again, you put on that shirt because?
To disguise myself, so I don't draw attention.
Okay. Is it, I mean, you hadn't been there in a year or so, but is that kind of the same shirt they have for the most part, you think?
Almost every kid in JRTC had that shirt.
Okay.
So there really is a lot of planning for a mass murderer, probably more than I considered. Cruz had everything down and ready to go, even thinking about his clothes so he would blend in. As you've said, Amanda, he planned everything right up until the shooting, planned it seemingly pretty well, but didn't think about afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, he probably thought it might have been likely that he would go down in gunfire, but, you know, we just heard that he knew that he had to get in and out because of how long this active shooter thing works. So, you know, and he knew that by wearing his ROTC uniform that people wouldn't look twice at him. Mm. Like, most of the kids, well, some of the kids would have known him because he did go to that school. And even one of the security guards had said, Cruz is heading over to the 1200 block where the bag, like, you know, he could have been taken down well before. That's why they have security guards there. You know, but yeah, he's going into everything that he packed, that he had to get it all going. We know that he had Pumped Up Kicks playing. We know that he was looking at violent shootings to see how they'd all go down. But yeah, he dumped the bags and everything as he left, because obviously that would have made him stick out a bit. Mm. But, you know, he knew that he had to blend in. He knew he had to do this in a certain time. He had done all of that planning, you know, and we think that these are crimes of passion, you know, it's the rejected kid, but it's not. He had been planning this for a long time. Once he had his target, he was right to go.
You know, he also said he didn't sleep the night before. That makes a lot of sense. You know, he's excited about what's coming. You know, I guess it's how a mass murderer gets into the zone, but he's excited because he knows this major event that he's been planning for a long time is happening tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he prepped right up until that time. He had even asked JT to go and feed his dogs, you know, and that was something that Zach said in the last episode. He said, you know, you're not going to see the dogs anymore, which was just something else that was heartbreaking in that piece. But he had thought all of this. He had spoken to JT. He had sent things to the girl he liked. He was playing music. He was reading about shootings right up until the moment he got into that Uber, sent the last couple of SMSs, and then walked into that school ready to go. Regardless of people saw him, he was ready to go, and he was going to go and just shoot as much as he could in that senior block.
Well, next Cruz is asked about his trip to the school in an Uber, particularly about the long bad he had with him, and again, he had the answers.
Where did you sit in the car? The back seat?
Yeah, back seat.
Okay. And
I told her that I had musical instruments. I was in the orchestra.
Okay. And how come you did that?
So I can get away with getting my guns in the car and going to the school.
And what did she say to that?
She said, okay.
Why wouldn't she? He says he's in the orchestra. He really does have an answer to everything, doesn't he?
He does. And, you know, she didn't even go, oh, I don't know, you know. And I feel so sorry for her because she was sort of put into this horrible event, and just by doing her job, you know, it's just crazy. But, yeah, he seems to be, you know, charming and disarming, that he could actually say, oh, yeah, you know, he had that answer before she said, what the hell's that, you know.
Mm.
She did not get the hint that he was a school shooter. She sort of, you know, judged him as, you know, a kid in the orchestra. You know, it makes perfect sense. And unfortunately, that wasn't the truth. But he was ready with that answer in case he was asked.
Yeah. And Scott continues with Cruz's journey. Now he's arrived at school. Now what?
Once you get to school, what's your next step?
Walk through the gates. Hopefully there's no security guards, which I was wrong.
So what I haven't been to that school, so are there lots of gates, or how do you get to it?
Three gates.
Okay, and so where did they drop you off?
The front gate. Okay. Of the school.
Front gate. And so is your backpack, like sometimes you can wear a backpack like slump on your shoulder?
Yeah, it was in front. I think I was wearing it in the front.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And then what were you doing with the gun safe bag?
I was walking.
Okay. And you're...
I think south of Humberg Road.
Okay, you're walking with it, and you have the backpack kind of on one side. And then what happened?
I went through the gates. I looked at the guy who was watching me.
Oh, there was a guy watching you?
Yeah.
Was it that?
I saw him radioing, and I said, oh, shit, I'm screwed. So I just ran into the building. And I told the kid to get out of here. I don't remember what I exactly said, but I said something.
Was the guy that you saw radioing and you said, oh, shit, I'm screwed. Was it the, remember we were talking about some other security guy? Was that that same guy?
No.
No, totally different one?
Totally different.
And so what did you think when you saw him talking on the radio? What do you think that was about?
I thought he was going to, I think he called Scott Pearson.
Okay. And what would that mean if he did?
Scott Pearson was coming.
Okay, and what would that mean for your plan that day?
To shoot.
Okay, so Cruz didn't really answer what Dr. Scott was asking, did he? Scott wanted to know if he had to go quicker because the guard spotted him.
Yeah, and I think he wasn't understanding what Scott was saying about that, because, yeah, his plan was to go in and to shoot, and he almost shied away from that answer but still gave it. But, yes, that's not what he was asking. But, you know, he would have known that he had to go faster. He knew that he had to get out quicker because he'd already been seen before he had killed anyone. That's the important part, you know. But you can literally hear his disappointment, you know. But at the same time, you know, this is a non-student with a big kit bag.
Yeah.
Why don't they just go out and see him then and there? They are armed.
Well, they're armed, and they are supposed to go and save lives, aren't they? You know, there's 17 people who didn't make it because of their inaction.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he was spotted at 2:19.
Mm. Yeah.
First responders were there at 2:32.
Now, in the next episode, Dr. Cruz is going to talk about Cruz's escape and his time at McDonald's. Now, you might remember we watched that in a previous episode, what happened when he went to McDonald's and sat next to that student. We're going to find out Cruz's point of view about that in the next episode of Monsters Who Murder. And, Amanda, we're also going to start going into the trial.
Yes, we are, because it's fresh off the press, so we've got a lot to go through. It's a lot of hours to watch, but I'm getting there.
You are. Well, that's all in the next episode of Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions. The McDonald's thing I'm really interested in, especially because we heard the student talk about it. So I can't wait to see that. I'm Rob McKnight. She is the true crime author, criminologist, and most notably serial killer whisperer, Amanda. We go to McDonald's on next week's episode.
I have to have some.
Yes.
Yeah.
That sounds good to me. We'll see you next time.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.